Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, the podcast kid. That's such a bad joke, but it's like, it's obvious.
It feels right.
It's there.
It's the podcast kid, sure. With us today is Jamel Bowie, columnist for the New York Times, to talk about Clint Eastwood's masterpiece, Unforgiven. Thank you so much for being here, Jamel.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jamel, I'm curious about your history with this film. I mean, did you see this film in 92? Did you see it around 92?
I would have been 5 years old in 1992. So I did not see Unforgiven back in 92. I saw this movie for the first time. I want to say I was still living in D.C., so I want to say either 2015 or 2016, probably 2015 as I'm thinking about it. But I loved it when I saw it the first time. I am kind of a big Clint fan. I really like his work as a director. I feel like people find this surprising about me because like, oh, well, Jamel, you know, he's like a lefty. Obviously, he holds Clint Eastwood in contempt. I do not. He's a director actually I really like.
You know, it's interesting because I feel like for the longest time, politically, Clint Eastwood felt a little bit sort of amorphous. And then
he's always been very libertarian. And that has sort of gotten more terrifying across his career.
Sure.
But like, like this movie, you watch this movie and you're like, oh, this is just a movie about how like the only person who can solve society is like just like a good man. Like, and he's not a good man, but like a man who's like less bad than other people, I guess would be the way to put it.
Or acknowledges his shortcomings, I guess, to some degree.
I'm interested to hear. I also like Eastwood. I don't like all his films, but who possibly could? But I'm interested to hear what you respond to in his work, Jamel.
I think Unforgiven is a film that kind of encapsulates this to an extent, because I don't think it actually is so much only this singular good man can solve the problem. I think, especially in his later career, which is weird. Okay, I got to say, this movie is very much sort of like revisionist Western, revisionist Clint Eastwood taking a revisionist take on himself. And you can be like, oh yeah, he's had this like reevaluation of his own mythos in the back half of his career, but he's been like making movies for 30 years since. And so it's like, in a funny way, it's sort of like, well, this is just what he does now. Like the older stuff, the pre Unforgiven stuff feels like a different guy, and then post Unforgiven. But I think one thing he's interested in is just sort of like one of the things he's interested in is the deleterious effect of violence on someone's like identity, psyche, like sense of integrity, sort of like these characters he seems to really dig into. Money in this, Chris Kyle in American Sniper, his character in his most recent film, Cry Macho, even, are these people who are sort of marked by violence, and it's like destroyed them. And they are trying to negotiate that, and they find themselves in situations where the violence once again becomes used, like in Unforgiven, the violence, his ability to do violence, it becomes necessary and useful, but it's always portrayed as sort of like, oh, this is the worst thing that could happen to this guy. Mm-hmm. Like the best thing that could have happened to Will Money is that he didn't try to get this bounty at all, that he just stayed home with his kids. And as soon as he left to do it, it basically put him on a trajectory to relapse, almost like an addict, right? Mm-hmm. Into his worst possible self.
Yeah. Yeah. I think American Sniper is an interesting comparison point because I saw that. That was like a big movie at Vox for obvious reasons, because like the conversation around that movie was like, what does this say about foreign policy? Which, like, I mean, you can have that conversation, but I'm not sure. It's like, that was the Vox conversation to have about American Sniper, though a lot of publications said that. And I like went and saw it sort of through that lens. And I was like, this movie's weirder than that. I still think it has some pretty big flaws, but like there's a fake baby in it. But but like it's like the way that it depicts Chris Kyle's like inability to give up this violence, like almost his addiction to it. Eastwood is so interested in that idea. And like, I think Unforgiven is my favorite of his movies, which is like the least hot take of all time. But like, I think it's because this movie digs into that the most. I remember at the time he said he was never going to make another Western. I didn't actually check this, but
he did. He said he wasn't going to act or direct another movie. In fact, he kind of made it seem like this was his hat tip. And then, you know,
that's the thing. It's sort of like, yeah, I'm going out on this deconstruction of the idea of Clint Eastwood. And then it's a huge hit. It's like, it's maybe one of the most successful things he's ever done.
Yep.
And he's like, oh, I guess not.
I mean, he also, the man loves attention as well. I mean, yes. It does feel as though, I mean, in the research I was doing on this film, just reading about how like he never thought he'd win an Oscar. He was convinced that was just never going to happen for him. And then this movie comes out. It's a big hit. It's starting to seem like that's possible. And he was with Frances Fisher at the time, who plays the sort of the lead prostitute, if that's the right way to put it. I guess sort of
the brothel madam.
Sure. And she was pregnant at the time, and he was like, don't tell anyone you're pregnant because it'll take away from my Oscar campaign. Like just all sorts of weird, like he's a weird guy. I mean, he's got like, on the Wikipedia page, it says he has at least like 13 children. They're not even really sure how many kids the guy has. It's kind of amazing.
I don't want to make this like, let's talk about Eastwood's entire career. But one thing I found really funny about The Mule, a movie I really like, is that whole thing seems to be Eastwood being like, you know what? I'm terrible to women. I'm like awful to women. I'm a terrible man to women, and I deserve to suffer for it.
But I also deserve to have two threesomes.
Yes, yeah, right. Don't get me wrong.
Bill, women just had sleep balloons. With me.
I don't know why balloons just showed up, but that's what happened.
It's because you said two threesomes. That's the Zoom trigger. It makes the balloon.
I don't know.
My wife was pregnant when I was up for a Hugo Award, and I asked her not to tell anyone she was pregnant because I didn't want it to just. And then I lost.
Obviously.
So, yeah.
Oh wow. To go sort of back to what you were saying about what you were both saying about sort of the weight of killing, which feels is very much sort of a theme in this film of not being able to get over something like that. And even with sort of the kid character who talks a big game, talks about how he's killed all these people, but he hasn't. And then when he actually does, it like really fucks him up, as it should. I just, it does feel like on a grander scale, this film is about sort of sins as well, and like not being able to get over any bad deeds that you've done. Mm-hmm. It's also about older people, right? I mean, most of these people are quite old and they're looking back on their years of, yes,
it's so funny to think about like Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman in this movie playing the old guys. And now they're both still act. They're both still making movies. It's just, what a world we live in.
I mean, by the way, I would argue they both kind of look the same. I mean, it's been a long time. Clint's looking a little.
You can tell. Still, you can tell they look older, but it feels like they look like 10 years older. It's pretty wild. Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. This movie is just very much of a sort of being haunted by the past, which I feel, you know, to your point, Jamel, about how this seemed like Clint's way out, right, as a career, his way of being like, this is a perfect kind of grace note to a career of playing guys like this. And then he's just kept on going, playing guys like this and making movies about this.
I watched his 1982 movie, Honky Tonk Man, earlier this year, because I was doing a different podcast about country music movies, and that is weirdly kind of a precursor to Unforgiven. It's like one of the few movies he actually dies in. This is apparently a thing that he never does on screen, but like, it is another movie that is like, I've lived this hard life. I've hurt a lot of people. In that movie, he's a country western singer, so violence doesn't really get involved, but it's very much like, I have hurt the people in my life, the women and the relatives and family. And it just is like, he's fascinated by this theme. Every Clint Eastwood movie kind of tells on himself a little bit. And I think that's why he's such a compelling figure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's also, you know, the thing that kind of hit me watching it this time was how economic the filmmaking is here. And I just mean in terms of like the cleanliness, the storytelling. I mean, obviously the man shoots movies very quickly. He's made a lot of them. He made this film in 37 days, which is,
that is crazy.
Like, not a lot of takes. He's just like, so I really feel like you can see it just in the way that the script is too. Like, it's just very, very sharp and clean and knows what it's telling.
He sort of famously doesn't do a lot of script notes either. Like, you know, people don't really draft for him. And like, this script is airtight. Like, it's looking at, this is the first time I've watched it since I became a working screenwriter. And I was watching it through that lens. And I was like, oh my God, every scene in this, even though it's like kind of a like Shaggy Dog story in a certain way, because the English Bob kind of doesn't amount to anything, but like, it's also like so important to the overall themes. It's a really like,
well, it gives us a lot of depth into Bill, right? Like, it gives us more on Little Bill.
That I always say, English Bob and Little Bill, that's the note I would have had. Change one of their names. Fix that.
He actually only had one note from what I read, which was that the text that scrolls at the beginning and the end of the film was originally VO, and he was like, actually just make a text, which I think is kind of a whatever
done
note.
He could have just done that in the edit, Clint.
But I also kind of like that it's text. I agree with him that if it was voiceover, I don't think it would have been as effective. Reading those words, which are poetic, and also like the fact that this film ends with basically him being like, I don't know why anyone would want to be around Will, bad dude. Mm-hmm. I think that's just kind of phenomenal.
So I think the other thing about the text being something that you read is that the actual first spoken words you hear in the film are the saloon keeper, the innkeeper with the gun to the head of one of the cowboys. I forget what exactly he said. It's something vulgar, right? So it's
awful.
Yeah. But it's sort of like if the opening shot of someone kind of like, I think it's just Clint burying his wife, creates the impression that this is going to be sort of an elegiac movie. The fact that the first words you hear and the first reaction you see is this like attempted rape and murder, followed by the innkeeper threatening to kill this cowboy, it's like, no, this is going to be a movie about the kind of men these men actually were.
I think a lot about, I think that the thing about revisionist Westerns and watching this, like, it came out while I was alive. I didn't see it in theaters. I didn't see it until I was in my 20s, probably. But like, thinking about it through the lens of, I knew what Westerns were, and I knew like the Western archetypes, because I grew up at the very tail end of this era when like Westerns were still kind of in our cultural ether. And like now they kind of aren't. And I wonder if the revisionist Western has just become the Western for a lot of people, because it seems like the only one that gets made anymore. I don't know how. I'm not saying we should make more traditional Westerns, because but sure. Certainly like, you know, the I'm tired of the comparisons of superhero movies to Westerns, because they're very different in genres in many ways. But there certainly is that element of like, it's so set in stone that there needs to be a revisionist take, but in a certain way, the revisionist take always becomes the standard take. I'm making no sense.
I was just going to very quickly say that I think that like the Coen brothers, if you look at True Grit or you look at No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. those are, you know, these sort of deconstructed versions of the Western. I don't know that a clean Western would exist today, but Jamal, what were you going
to
say?
No, I was just about to say that it seems to me that sort of like, yes, most modern Westerns are revisionist Westerns, whether that is something that is a period piece, like The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, a movie I love, by the way, that like I feel like doesn't get enough.
It's beautiful.
You know, it's and a wonderful score. Anyway, the 3:10 to Yuma remake is also very much like revisionist Western stylistically. And then you have like the kind of more like the contemporary Western. So you mentioned No Country for Old Men, but Hell or High Water. It's another one of these. They're all kind of like in that revisionist vibe. The kind of like triumphant, you know, lone hero, you know, native others who are a threat. Some, you know, Anglo person who represents disorder that needs to be like corralled and controlled, that kind of thing that no one really makes anymore. It doesn't really. And what's funny to me is that it's not only that no one really makes it anymore, but when people like the revisionist Western has become the Western to such an extent that people will look back at older revisionist Westerns, like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance or any of Anthony Mann's Westerns, and be like, oh, that's a great like classic Western. It's like, well, no, that's like very explicitly a revisionist Western, but we've lost like the cultural language of sort of like the, like a stagecoach, right? A John Ford, a classic John Ford Western.
So would you say that John Ford and like Sergio Leone are these sort of the you know, tip of the spear when it comes to the classic? I'm not a Western guy, so that's why I was gonna
get to that in a second, Phil.
Just being honest.
I think yes, obviously, but like it's kind of like the first half of Ford's career. Because like The Searchers, for instance, is a revisionist Western. Like I got into a long argument about that movie a while back, and sort of like its depiction of race is problematic from a modern standpoint, but it like at the time it was like talking about like this a topic in a way that literally no movie had really attempted at that scale. At least I'm sure there were smaller films, but yeah, it's like Ford and then the Westerns of Howard Hawks, and you know, obviously there are tons and tons and tons of like serials and like those sorts of things that were feeding into this, and there was just so much of it that like it became inescapable. But yes, like all these guys that like made the great classical Westerns then made movies that deconstructed the Westerns for like the second half of their careers. It's such an interesting, like, and I think Leone like is also kind like, obviously his form becomes a new type of Western, but at the time it was also like, what can we do here? That's revisionist in the sense of stripping something down instead of deconstructing it. But that is a kind of revisionism.
Well, I'm also curious because you brought up race and this film, you know, doesn't talk about race really. I mean, I'm curious, in fact, in the script, whether Ned was actually written to be black or not, because it is just interesting that the lack of discussion about that. I mean, do you guys have thoughts on that?
I was thinking about, like, I was bracing for this movie to be worse, like overtly worse, to be clear. Like, and I was also bracing for it to be like, obviously there's extreme cruelty to women in the like first 10 minutes, but I was bracing for a lot more of that. And there just isn't. It's like, I'm obviously it's because the David Webb People script was written in like 1972 and like Clint just hung on to it for a long time. Yeah. But I think there's something I think there's something interesting in Morgan Freeman playing Ned in how the movie doesn't examine it, because like I don't know how much Clint Eastwood is aware of what he's touching on, in especially in the immediate wake of the Rodney King beating with right. with Little Bill, not Little Bob, with Little Bill flogging Ned to death. It's a brutal, horrible sequence, and Eastwood understands that, and I don't know like if he's like even thinking about this other component of it.
Yeah, the Ned, like Ned's race is never really remarked on in the film, even by characters that you are anticipating they're going to remark on it. So the kid, you're always like, he's always sneering and always like, and there's a sense of like sort of like maybe the actor is portraying a sort of like just under the surface prejudice. It's not being expressed out of respect for Will. But it seems like if anyone's going to say use a slur, it's going to be that guy. But there's none of that in the film, and part of me does wonder if Clint just wasn't particularly attentive to it, if the character wasn't written as a black man, and so because nothing about the character necessitates him being black, he just happens to be a black guy. You know, when you look at the historical West, there are lots of, you know, what we call black cowboys, like black people were very much in the mix. And, you know, this is actually kind of interesting, sort of like, you know, explicit separation isn't really imposed until what we think of as like civilization pops up. It's sort of like, while it's the frontier, people are kind of like loosey-goosey about this stuff. But once it seems like, oh, this is going to be a settled place, then it's like, okay, well, now we have to have racial segregation. Giving you a sense of how people understood segregation to like what how they understood it as a social structure. But yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say if Eastwood sees the resonance. I mean, I'm sure he's aware of the resonance of Ned being flogged. Like you'd have to be a dummy, right, to not get that. But there doesn't appear to be like any comment. It's just sort of like perhaps the reason Little Bill is flogging Ned and not any of the other two is because Ned is black, and like Little Bill feels like if I can get one of them, that's the one I can get. But then also maybe not. You know, it doesn't appear to be a part of the story in an interesting way. Like the absence of it to me makes it as interesting as anything else.
Yeah.
And the absence of his death as well. We don't actually see it on screen.
That's right.
I think is also interesting. You know, it's more of a gut punch, quite frankly, that it's told to him after the fact than the viewer not knowing that either. And then seeing his corpse on display and the sort of the indignity of that, I think is obviously it's really powerful, but I think there's choices being made. The mm-hmm. cognizant choices of storytelling and what he's trying to say with it. But yeah, something.
And like not to return to the script, but like you see that also in the script for Blade Runner, which David Webb Peoples also wrote, which is like a thing happens off screen. Someone is told about it. Then they go see the aftermath. And like, I love that kind of storytelling, but you're so often like steered away from it in screenwriting seminars or whatever. And like, I think this movie really shows how much power can reside in those images. And Jamil, you're talking about the ways that the Wild West or whatever we call it now had like sort of different social mores, because also like that was a world where like women had the vote earlier. Like there's all this stuff
that's
like society is like very different out, and then more people move in, and it's like, and this movie is depicting that shift, like because there's like big Little River, Big Whiskey, is I know I watched this movie last night. I know what's happening. Is this like town and it's the gap between 1878 when he buries his wife and 1880 when the movie takes place. It's like, oh, this thing has happened. Society is here, and now it brings with it terrible sheriffs who actually were previously outlaws, but now are like
right,
the law. It's interesting.
Right. Now are there to bring, they're now there to bring order, but it's a very particular kind of like personalized patriarchal kind of order, right? They don't really represent the state so much because the state is impersonal. They represent sort of personalized rule and the creation of order over this society. I don't have
it dictatorial in its own way.
Yeah. I mean, this is sort of orthogonal to our conversation, but one of the things that I found interesting about Killers of the Flower Moon, which takes place in sort of like the post-frontier Oklahoma, is that like half the story is about the replacement of personalized rule, personalized patriarchal authority with the authority of the state. When the Bureau of Investigation shows up, it's like now the state is entering the picture. And I find that so much of the work that takes place in this late 19th century, early 20th century period is in a lot of ways about that transition from the rule of a single man to that of a bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in this world, and well, not in Wyoming, but I grew up in South Dakota, which is right next door. And it very much was like the after effects of that shift were everywhere. They were like in our cultural DNA, just as like you were sort of raised with, like, well, and as you want, like a lot of people wonder why those states are so rabidly Republican. And it's often because they still deeply resent the state for coming in and imposing any kind of order. Even like the deeply flawed order that we possess within the United States and always have is like resented for existing within those spaces.
I want to give just a little bit of context to half an hour
Phil,
into this episode.
So good. I'm doing the best that I can, guys.
When prostitute Delilah Fitzgerald is disfigured by a pair of cowboys in Big Whiskey, Wyoming, her fellow brothel workers post a reward for their murder. Much to the displeasure of Sheriff Little Bill, played by Gene Hackman, who does not allow vigilantism in his town. Two groups of gunfighters, one led by aging former bandit William Money, played by Clint Eastwood, the other led by florid English Bob, played by Richard Harris, come to collect the reward, clashing with each other and the sheriff. Unforgiven opened on August 7th, 1992, in first place against Death Becomes Her, Raising Kane, Three Ninjas, A League of Their Own, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $159 million on a $14 million budget. It's got 96% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 93% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 stars, said it has the elements of a crime picture, but the freedom of an art film. Unforgiven 2 uses a genre as a way to study human nature, that implacable moral balance in which good eventually silences evil at the heart of the Western, and Eastwood is not shy about saying so. Should also be said that Unforgiven won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor for Gene Hackman, and Best Film Editing. It was also nominated for Best Actor for Clint Eastwood, Best Screenplay, Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography. The cinematography, I feel, in this film is stunning. This movie is beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
I would argue it's better looking than the winner A River Runs Through It.
Listen, I'm imagining a double feature of Unforgiven and Three Ninjas. That would be quite the day.
There you go. What's first, though?
I was just thinking, I mean, it's so striking to read sort of list of releases like in the in the early 90s at the very least, because it's sort of like, oh, these are like anyone could go to the movies that weekend and be like, oh, there's something for me. I'm a kid and I want to see kid shit. I can see the Three Ninjas. I'm a little weird little freak and I want to see like a weird little freak movie. I can go see Raising Kane. You know, I want to I like that
it's
movie.
True.
But yeah. That's like that the audience it's a DePaul it's De Palma. Yeah, it's sure. The audience for that is like little freaks.
Yeah, for sure. This is also August 7th. You know what I mean? Like this is the first weekend in August. This was I mentioned this on the online last night. The teaser poster for this film, which is I would argue groundbreaking, is just the back of Clint Eastwood. He's holding a gun. It says Unforgiven August 7th. It's literally a Batman poster. It just isn't a Batman poster.
Because he was such an icon that they could just do that. They could just be like, look at this guy. He's got a gun again. How do you feel about that?
And it's like, you know, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm looking at this weekend again. I just to continue this because it's, you know, it's kind of crazy. So I want to go see like an adult prestige drama, Unforgiven. I want to see sort of like a weird kind of comedy, Death Becomes Her. I want to see just a weird movie, Raising Kanan, kid movie, Three Ninjas, family friendly movie, A League of Their Own. And then below that, right, you know, maybe I go see Mo Money, Mo Problems. Maybe I go see Sister Act. You know, maybe I go see Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. Like there's something there for everyone. Yeah. And this is just like a typical, it's a pretty typical weekend.
This is me. I'm not apologizing to Phil, but I'm admitting I was wrong about something. When we started this project, because this podcast started out being about the movies of 1999, an iconic film year, and I was not the host at that time. And I'm still not. I'm a special guest host, and your normal host is the podcast kid. But 1992, I was like, Phil, why are you doing 1992? But it is this kind of last gasp before franchise filmmaking really started to take over aggressively in the next few years. Because by the time you get to 99, a lot of those movies you just listed were increasingly getting difficult to get made. And now, like, they'd all be Disney Plus series. Disney Plus should make a Raising Kanan series. That's the conclusion of this. Yeah.
but to both your points, you know, I would even argue that by 99, I mean, 97 even, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit in previous episodes, but, you know, 93 is Jurassic Park, you know what I mean? And which feels like a game changer. And once special effects become more manageable or more plausible, and you can start actually doing that sort of stuff, you stop seeing movies made for adults and you start seeing movies that are made for sort of these four quadrant things. I mean, we did an episode, Jamel, on Basic Instinct, which made $400 million in 1992.
Which is just an insane thing to think about. It's just it's crazy to think, hey, this horny European movie gonna get a general release and everyone's gonna see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different world. It really is.
Phil.
Yes, Emily? Yeah.
I got to ask the question. You're not a Western person. So how do you feel about Unforgiven?
Oh,
if you're not a Western fan and you're watching this, do the revisionist aspects, like, obviously, you know, they're there, but do they like hit in the same way?
Well, they don't hit in the same way because I don't have the knowledge necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, as a student of film, it's hard not to kind of look at this and be like, well, this is clearly breaking a lot. You know what I mean? There's a lot of deconstruction going on here. I'm obviously aware of the iconography of Clint Eastwood in and of itself. As I was watching it, I was hit by a lot of things. I think Clint Eastwood is really, really good in this movie. Like, I think he gives a tremendous performance. I think that Clint Eastwood as an actor has a relatively narrow range. And I don't say that as a bad thing. I think he's very good at very specific things. But I watched this, and the end of the film, when he shows up and it's raining and he's got this gun and he looks like a fucking badass, and the conflicted feelings you have as a viewer of like, he seems like a hero in this moment, and yet this moment is rife with so much, you know, complexity and awfulness, and no one in this scene is good, and they all kind of deserve to die. Feels antithetical in my brain to what I assume the Western is supposed to be about.
And that is interesting, because I do feel like I've seen Stagecoach and a couple of Howard Hawks. Like, I'm not like a scholar of the genre, but like, it is... Sure. It is interesting the degree to which that iconography still lodges in your brain as either I think an American or like a pop culture person or like a movie person, just like, you know, it's in the back there. I actually just checked this because I had remembered this and Ebert and Siskel both gave it really mixed reviews. Like Ebert upgraded it when he added it to the, he gave it 2.5 stars on initial release. He gave it a very mild thumbs up on the show, and Siskel like kind of hated it and spent most of that award season complaining about Unforgiven and just being like, why do people like this movie? I fucking love those guys. They just like had the weirdest opinions sometimes.
I feel like Ebert actually, I mean, because he had his whole great movies books, right, that he would put out.
Right.
And I feel like he would sort of revisit mm-hmm. things that maybe mm-hmm. he did. Siskel didn't really do that.
Yeah, yeah. Ebert added this to his great movies list in 2002, and every time he did that, he just gave it 4 stars. And it's like, yeah. But his great movies piece is amazing, but like his original review, which has been pulled from the internet, was kind of like, I don't know about this.
I mean, to very briefly talk about sort of the development of this film, it was not a Clint Eastwood film originally. It was a Francis Ford Coppola movie. He had the rights to it prior to Eastwood getting it in the early 80s. He wanted John Malkovich to play Will. And at one point, Malkovich was asked about it. And he's like, who wants to see that movie? Like, why does anyone want to see that movie? Which I think is kind of amazing. I don't know what that movie is, but...
How old was Malkovich at that time? Like, that's...
I mean, this is the 80s.
Obviously, you could do this movie with a guy in his 30s. Like, you really could. It gained so much from being about a guy in his... Eastwood was in his 60s at the time, I think. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, Malkovich would have been in his 30s. Yeah, in the 80s. Yeah.
It's weird. But I also think that, you know, Eastwood's talked about this a lot, but that, like, once the script was brought to his attention, he bought the rights to it, and he wanted it to sit on it for a while because he wanted to be of an age that it made sense. He wanted to be, you know, older and haggard. But then he obviously comes around to it. As I mentioned, shot in 39 days, coming in 4 days ahead of schedule.
Oh, my God.
God bless this man. just unbelievable. You mentioned the screenwriter, Emily, David Webb Peoples, who
insanely good batting average, just like everything good. He does gold.
I mean, it's pretty crazy. He obviously Blade Runner. He does this. He talks about how he was inspired by Taxi Driver and Glendon Swarthout's novel, The Shootist, which I don't know of. But I don't know if
I've never read,
you've read
it.
That or know of that. And then he writes 12 Monkeys with his wife, mm-hmm. A great movie. He's just a pretty phenomenal screenwriter. Just amazing stuff. I don't know. I mean, Jeremy Irons was apparently considered for English Bob, which
that would have been fun.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard Harris is great in this, but there's something about Richard Harris and Gene Hackman being of similar ages. But I guess Jeremy Irons is pretty old at this point. But
I mean, it wouldn't. I guess Jeremy Irons would be in his 40s. Given what he was doing at the time, maybe not psychosexual enough for him.
I mean, still not psychosexual.
Yeah, enough for him. I just watched. What are the two Cronenberg movies?
The one Dead Ringers.
Dead Ringers, and then also Madam Butterfly.
Oh sure,
yeah.
Oh
sure. So I just
that movie is complicated.
Yes, it is.
And a movie that, quite frankly, kind of doesn't exist in a weird way. Like, it's not even, people don't even think that Cronenberg made that movie.
Not at all.
I feel like Cronenberg makes a lot of movies that people just forget are real, you know, and that's
forget.
It's not even that they don't exist. It's that they feel like a hallucination you had one time.
Well, M. Butterfly is just, yeah, crazy movie. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting to think of Jeremy Irons in this. That being said, I want to talk about the Gene Hackman performance.
I have to tell a Jeremy Irons story. Yeah, please, I interviewed him for Watchmen. Because I bullshitted my way into going to the Watchmen press day in New York because I wanted to go to New York, which is what I did at Vox all the time. And he was like in a room by himself, just like eating little like olives. And I was like, I think they were olives. They might have been like fucking capers or something.
Who knows?
And I just was like asking him questions about, like, you know, because like at that point in the day, I didn't care. So I was just like asking him the most basic ass questions about Watchmen and like playing the character he plays. I don't know why I'm not spoiling this, but like, and he just was like, well, I had no idea what I was doing, but it was fun. I had a good time. It was wonderful. Best celebrity interview.
I mean, that sounds right. That tracks. The Gene Hackman of it all, I think, is interesting. I mean, the man's made a million movies, so we're not going to go through his filmography, but I do wanted to kind of talk about where he is at this point in his career. You know, he does this film in 92. He does The Firm in 93. He's in Geronimo, An American Legend, a movie I've never seen, so I can't speak to that. Wyatt Earp, Quick and the Dead. He's doing a lot of Westerns after this. It feels as though he's sort of in that mode.
He's playing a lot of villains too. Like, he always has played anti-heroic figures, but he's playing a lot of outright. Yeah. This is
in
the
Quick and the Dead. He is like he's just straight up antagonist. Yeah. Like in this, he's like he's not like I hesitate to call him a villain in Unforgiven. He is just sort of like he is a symbol of a certain kind of authority, mm-hmm. and
totally
people have different relationships to that.
Yeah. Yeah,
he has a line at the end of this movie that I found really haunting. I don't deserve to die like this. I was building a house. It's moments before Will shoots him in the face with a shotgun. but there is something about all the scenes of him building that house and how much it means to him. Like when Saul Rubinek makes that sort of joke about firing the person that constructed the house because there's so many leaks in the roof, and you could tell how much that hurts him. Like, this house really is this sort of personification of I am building something. I am, which I think is the way he sees his town as well. Like, I think he really does believe that he's doing good.
Traditionally, like I filter everything through Deadwood because it's a show I've seen 10 billion times, and I love that show. But like, traditionally, like in these stories, you have a house and it's in a town, and that means that society is here. And like the fact that like, but like, so like the fact that there's like leaks in the roof and everything is like has sort of a real symbolic import. On Deadwood, it is a very like you build a house and trap yourself in a sham marriage.
Yeah, like anyone does.
Yeah.
but I do think that, you know, the casting of Hackman is key because, you know, as you just sort of illustrated, Jamel, that like he's playing a lot of villains around this point, but he also plays just very complicated guys. If you look at, you know, French Connection, if you look at these characters, he's always sort of playing this duality of him. He's also very human and very funny. I mean, in 95, he's got Quick of the Dead, Crimson Tide, and Get Shorty. I mean, those are three drastically different movies, and it just goes to show the range that Gene Hackman had. It's key to cast him in this role.
Go ahead.
In addition to that element of his range, I recently saw The Conversation. We have a local theater in town that does lots of repertory stuff, and so it's like it's really great. And I recently saw The Conversation there. I guess there's a new restoration. And what I was struck by, kind of paradoxically, given I'm seeing him on the big screen, is how small he seemed to make himself through so much of that movie, like how small and vulnerable. And I feel like that's an aspect of Gene Hackman's range that doesn't get enough attention, that he's very capable of making himself seem quite vulnerable. And that kind of comes through in this movie, in this guy asserting authority, but also not, he's not like it, like in the Quick and the Dead, he's like this invulnerable titan. Although there are scenes where like you get some of the vulnerability, sort of like this is to some extent like a projection I'm doing. But in Unforgiven, Little Bill is like part of his willingness to exert violence is a sense that sort of like all of this is quite shaky. The house is leaking, right? Sort of like all my actual hold on this little bastion of civilization is not as strong as it appears. And if I do not keep an iron fist, then we will once again be the frontier.
Totally. I've told this story in like six podcasts now, so there's no reason for me to tell again, but I'm going to.
Fantastic.
Genuinely, like, he did Royal Tenenbaums, and that felt like that was the last movie. That felt like but he had such a miserable time making it that he made a few more. But so, you know, Welcome to Mooseport ends up being the last one. But he's classic. In one episode of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Drives.
Yes,
Diners, Drive-Ins, best. And Dives, and it's the last thing he's ever been on camera for. And I hope it remains.
He seems so happy.
He's so happy. He's just sitting there in a restaurant in Santa Fe eating his eggs, and Guy Fieri comes up and is like, "Hey, how you doing?" And he's like, "I'm fine." It's not clear that Guy recognizes him at all. It's wonderful. No, perfect television.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
I assume that Guy does not know who he is whatsoever.
Yeah.
Hey, look at this! Look at this old man.
Yeah.
Look at this happy old man.
Look at this old man with weird screen presence. I'm going to get him on camera.
So on the Hackman thing, I wanted to talk for a second about the jail scene with Bob and Beauchamp, and him talking about Bob shooting an unarmed man. Basically, a gun explodes in the guy's hand and he doesn't have it. And it's this idea of shooting an unarmed man is something that comes up a lot in this movie, of, you know, killing someone who can't defend themselves, I guess, in one way or another, feels like the worst sin you can possibly do in this world.
It's a pretty big sin. I just want to be clear on that. It's not a bad thing. Yeah. I would rather someone not kill me if I'm, yeah, in general.
But it just feels like people say that a lot, even at the end. Yeah. You've got Saul Rubidek or Beauchamp being like, I don't have a gun. Mm-hmm. It's just this idea that, like, that's the thing. And it comes back to sort of the sins thing I was talking about earlier. But this feeds into when Will is sick. Will gets beaten by little Bill at one point, and he's close to death, and he's got a fever, and he's having all these visions of not all of them necessarily, but of people he's killed coming back to him. This idea of sort of, what is the afterlife? Mm-hmm. What have I done? What do I have on the other side of this? Mm-hmm. All of his sort of worst fears come to life, I think is wonderful.
I think if you die and everyone you've ever wronged gets to have like 5 minutes to tell you like how you failed them, that sounds like, I don't know. I'd sit that through it. Like... Yeah.
But it's just, I think it's interesting because I don't know. This doesn't seem like a particularly religious movie. You know what I mean? This movie, mm-hmm, doesn't really deal with religion. And Emily, obviously, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. But it does feel pretty agnostic about God. So these visions feel like the closest thing that we get to that.
It's, yeah, it's vaguely Christian. Like, it has that, it's kind of, I'd even go so far as to say it's vaguely Protestant. Like, it's not, okay, it's sure, not actually, but it is in that sort of way of, you know, again, the church entering these spaces was a sign of society entering these spaces. Certainly there were informal churches among, you know, the folks who worked along the trails. But like, once you plunk down that church, like, that was sort of the sign of like, society is here. You had a church first, and then like a town hall, and then like a school. Right, and like, right, when you watch the old Westerns, that is often like the iconography they're working with. So it is interesting that the church is absent here. But I think that's because, like, you know, if you have a good-hearted preacher or an evil preacher, whatever trope you have there, it just kind of doesn't. The movie's moral universe needs less certainty than religion will provide. Even the most complicated view of religion has a more like strong moral center than I think this movie, sure, wants to have. So it is like, but it is also vaguely like, yeah, God is like somewhere. I think a lot of Clint Eastwood's movies are about like realizing that God is somewhere, but he's not paying attention right now.
Yeah. Do you feel like, Jamel, do you feel like, you know, Clint talks about religion? Because I'm trying to think of movies where he does. And
no, religion doesn't really seem explicitly to enter the picture. I think Emily is right that there's like the divine exists in the world of Clint Eastwood movies, right? But it's, the presence is not.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Not necessarily felt. I don't know. That's the interesting question. I'm thinking of like Sully, where, sure, you know, he lands the plane, and the movie is like, well, this guy is exceptionally skilled, but sort of the fact that everything, it's so unlikely that it like should, like, I feel like it's a suggestion that sort of like, well, like God was on this guy's side, and, mm-hmm, sort of like part of like the conflict of the movie is like, well, how are you gonna How are you going to railroad this guy that God clearly blessed with his favor?
Yeah. A lot of railroading in the back half of Clint's career.
This guy gets guy getting railroaded by the government, by the media.
Clint should make a Jesus movie because in the Jesus, he got railroaded. He got... That would be so good.
That's so funny. Yes. The ultimate guy who got railroaded, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean, it feels that way. I mean, my God, it's incredible. I do think, though, that it kind of comes back to the fact that I think Clint, in his own way, is sort of an unknowable filmmaker. You know what I mean? Like, an unknowable figure to some degree. And I wonder whether or not he doesn't want to spoon feed his audience. He doesn't want to give them something. I wonder if he likes that ambiguity, if that's part of something that he's drawn to as a filmmaker. Because I'm just thinking about his filmography, or at least the films of his that I've seen, and I just do find it kind of fascinating that you can't really pinpoint him. He doesn't really want to be put in a box. I don't know if that's laziness. I don't know if that's like intent. It's hard to say.
It feels like it has to be intent, because there are recurring themes. Like, there are things he returns to again and again. I think he is self-consciously being ambiguous about about where he falls, and wants sort of the films to speak for themselves, and wants you to sort of like, you know, take them seriously on their own terms.
He definitely has gone through phases in his career, but he like is constantly like mixing up genre in a fascinating way. But like, obviously, as we alluded to, he's in this guy was railroaded phase right now. But like, it's, you know, the violence thing is the thing that he keeps coming back to through all of those. I'm thinking about after Unforgiven, he made a spate of movies that were kind of like, you know who does it great? Old guys. And it's like that kind of culminates in Space Cowboys, a very fun movie.
Space Cowboys, great movie.
Very fun movie.
A movie I went to go see at the movie theaters for a friend's 13th birthday.
Now, if anything screams 13th birthday party, it's Space Cowboys.
It's Space Cowboys.
But yeah, like I think, you know, you look at a movie like Firefox, which is this like weird sci-fi thing that like is like not very good, but he's also just like, he's fascinated in all genres as long as they're sort of narrowly interpreted through a very specific lens of being interested in questions of violence and heroism and like what it means to be a man who upholds a certain code. And obviously I'm using man very, he has films about women and all that, but it is, he's like, he'll make any movie in any genre based on that. And anytime he kind of strays from that idea is when he kind of struggles. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, a very, very strange,
that's a weird movie.
I just watched for my own podcast, I just watched J. Edgar, his 2011 J. Edgar Hoover movie. It's not very good, but it is along these lines where like he's interested in J. Edgar Hoover as this sort of like guy, as this guy who is trying to uphold a particular sort of like moral and political order, but who is also sort of like neurotic and insane.
Yeah.
And sort of like the in some sense sort of like not honest with himself. And he's like in that movie, he's sort of very interested in sort of like the clash of these two things. A guy who is not honest with himself and in some sense isn't honest with the country either. That's what he finds very interesting about Hoover. Also interesting about Hoover, I mean, this is not the, but the movie deals with sort of very young Hoover and very end of life Hoover, but kind of skips middle of life Hoover, which is when Hoover was this sort of like nationally recognized and quite popular figure. And I think it's interesting that sort of like that's not, we don't get to spend much time with Herbert Hoover, I mean not Herbert Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, when he is arguably one of the most popular people in the country or political figures in the country.
You ever just think about how at the end of Being the Ricardos, the big conclusion Aaron Sorkin comes up with is Desi Arnaz calls J. Edgar Hoover and J. Edgar Hoover's like, Lucy's not a communist. And everyone's like, yes.
Yay. Yeah, that
movie, you know, I never saw Being the Ricardos.
Well,
in this
I'm
film.
Sorry, I just spoiled it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I, you know, this, funny enough, I'm less likely to see it now that I know that this is a plot point.
I do think though, because I'm looking at sort of the later half of the post Unforgiven portion of Eastwood's directorial credits. I love Bridges of Madison County. I mean, really great movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I think that movie's wonderful, and I think it does show a different gear to Clint than I think anyone had seen previously as a filmmaker and as an actor. But you know, he also just, you know, Absolute Power or True Crime, Blood Work. These are all just like, these are anonymous movies, movies that like honestly don't exist.
Absolute Power is great. Absolute Power is wonderful. It is Clint Eastwood being like, I could stop Bill Clinton from getting the dick sucked.
Perfect.
I remember William Goldman wrote a movie with Eastwood. I think it was Absolute Power. And he like wrote in his book about like how Eastwood, he turned it in. Eastwood was like, no notes. And he was like, what? He's like, I had to work with this guy again. I obviously like Eastwood wins Best Picture twice, which is wild, but he wins again for Million Dollar Baby in 2004. And like that is I love that movie. I have never revisited it. I think it is, but I also think it's like an interesting like political statement from him, because it's very much like Clint Eastwood sort of believes on some level we all have to take care of each other and that we're all like people. Yeah. Like he believes that, but like also that just is like sometimes the way we take care of each other is we shoot other people, and you're like, okay. And like Million Dollar Baby is like sometimes the way we take care of each other is like we gracefully kill you so that you can like have your life or whatever. Another thing about Clint,
that movie was hard to watch. I didn't know what it was until I sat in the theater.
Oh yeah, I didn't either. But another thing about Clint Eastwood movies outside of Unforgiven is they often have one scene that's just dog shit, and like the rest of the movie's great. Million Dollar Baby, the famous example where like her family shows up and it's Margot Martindale, and you're like, what the fuck is this scene doing here?
I mean, what's interesting, The Flags of Our Fathers, Letters from Iwo Jima, sort of back to back, the sort of two sides of that war, I thought was a really fascinating experience. Again, I don't know why I'm getting balloons. What's going on? I got to turn off these things. But I thought that was just really interesting the way that he sort of, it's an interesting experiment. I don't know that either of those films totally work for me, but I thought that was maybe the boldest experiment he had done up until that point, until he cast the guys in 15, 17 to Paris, the guys that were actually on the train.
Oh, I forgot about that movie. That's a weird movie. That's really strange. It's funny because it is kind of like an avant-garde thing to do. And you're like, man, who is the filmmaker who did this? And it's like Clint Eastwood.
It's a crazy thing to do. He's done a lot of movies that, I mean, Invictus, Hereafter. These are movies that kind of...
That's his Oscar phase when he's like, I want to get that third Best Picture, baby. And then he enters the railroading phase. And it's,
Jersey Boys.
What a career.
My wife really likes Jersey Boys.
The movie or the play?
The movie.
Interesting.
Okay. I'm sure what does she love about it?
I think she just likes the Four Seasons.
They're great. I just like, you know, I think like a musical is a genre that trips up a lot of great filmmakers. And Clint Eastwood is one of them. That's my take on Jersey Boys.
Why do you think that is? Why the genre trips up a lot of filmmakers?
I think because it involves a kind of filmmaking rhythm that is increasingly out of favor. Like Eastwood is not like Eastwood. The example is just he's so sparse and musicals want to be a little bit big, but like Spielberg, obviously West Side Story is great, sure. And like what he understood is that like. It, but that like intuitively fits within his style of like doing these long runners that then also have tiny little compositions within them that like make sense. Like the musical wants to be shot basically from the audience, if that makes sense. It wants the camera to be back from the stage. And like, you know, I don't hate New York, but it is certainly like you see that and you're like, you can feel Scorsese trying to pull the musical over to him. But the musical is like very hard to budge. Certainly some filmmakers have, but.
I'm
sorry for interrupting. I just really quickly, I've always thought that Spike Lee could make a good musical.
Yes, absolutely.
This is a very strongly held opinion of mine. I feel like he has one in him.
Mm-hmm. His film documentary of Passing Strange, a wonderful Broadway show, is like one of my favorite projects of his. His American Utopia film that he did with David Byrne is also terrific. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I agree with
you. No, he would make a tremendous musical. I think part of it too is a filmmaker that makes a movie in 39 days is probably not going to make a great musical. Like, he's just not a guy who's going to take the time to do multiple takes and do the coverage and whatever. He's just like, I gotta go. I got a round of golf to play or whatever. Like, I just don't think
he doesn't even seem enthusiastic enough for it. You know, it's sort of like, you can just imagine, you know, you get the dancers ready to go and Clint's just like, all right, go ahead.
The fact that he doesn't say action is one of my favorite things about Clint. He just says, go ahead. And he doesn't say cut. He says, that's enough of that.
that to me is so funny. It's so, can you imagine you're acting for your life and you're trying to do like pouring out emotion and Clint's just like, all right, that's enough.
It's gotta be so demoralizing. Like, I just can't imagine. It's tremendous.
And the man has directed multiple Academy Award nominated Academy Award winning performances. He obviously knows how to work with actors, and yet he's still just like, yep, good work. Some of it is that he just trusts people, and some of it is that he's lazy, and it's great. Wonderful. I'm glad he exists.
It's wonderful. And I think part of the reason also that he acts in his own films, I think to some degree, is that too, where he's just like, I know how to do this. I know how to get this done. He's not in his next film, Jury Number Two, which I'm very curious about, which is Nicholas Holt is the lead in that film, where he's a juror who discovers that he might be responsible for the person for the murder of the person's on trial for. Railroaded.
Also feels very reminiscent of an early 90s Harrison Ford picture.
Totally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Or a John Grisham book. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's yeah. But to wrap this up, Jamel, we do ratings on this podcast where we do 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest.
I just want to talk about the big scene at the end. The big scene where they talk about death. The Schofield kid and Will like, that's when this movie goes from I'm really loving this movie to masterpiece for me. Like, that scene, the thing where, like, Will then has another conversation with the sex worker who comes out of town, and he turns back to the kid, and the kid's just like, he's not going to be living anymore, is he? And you're like, oh my God. Like, there's a profound, like, too few American movies are actually interested in the reality of death. Like, they claim that they are, they pretend to be, but like, when they actually think about the concept that someday you're not going to exist anymore, they kind of like step back from that a little bit. And this is like one of the few, including in Eastwood's like filmography, where he's made a lot of movies about death, but not one as forthright as this, that is just like interested in that thing. Like, oh yeah, none of us are going to make it out alive. And maybe, too often we assist other people on their way to that inevitable end.
He has this amazing line where he says, it's a hell of a thing killing a man. You take away all he's got and all he's ever going to have. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that just really hit me. That whole scene is the movie in a nutshell, right? Of just sort of this idea of the power of taking a person's life. and then later he has that line where he says, I've always been lucky when it comes to killing people. I totally agree with you. It goes into the void, right? Like, this movie just, you know, fearlessly goes there.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to bring it up. I think it's a great scene. That's me just talking.
I absolutely agree with you. The reason we're going to rate this film, and then Jamel, I'm curious as to your thoughts on the film we're covering next week, which is a movie that I imagine you will have thoughts on. So we do a ranking 0 to 99. I mean, I think this movie is a 95. I think it's pretty impeachably brilliant. I do think it's my favorite Clint Eastwood film. But where are you, Emily? Where do you fall in this movie?
I when I saw this movie the first time in like the 2000s, I was probably like a 94. I think I'm up to like a 97. The only two 92 movies I like more are Twin Peaks: Firewalk with Me and Malcolm X. And sure. I think all three of these are like major masterworks from directors who are among my favorites. I think this movie's pretty perfect. And weirdly, because Clint Eastwood didn't touch the script, the queerphobia scale is like a 2, where you know all these people. You know all these people hate gay people, but B, you also know they're all like kind of having sex with each other. And you're like, okay.
100%. For sure. Jamel, where do you fall on that? Where do you rate this movie?
I'd say 95 as well. I think that to Emily's point a little earlier, this is a movie that really does deal quite forthrightly with sort of how like morally corrosive it is to do violence to another person. That like it's the kind of thing that one doesn't really come back from. Like Will Money never comes back from it. And while he thanks his deceased wife for pulling him away from it, he seems to recognize sort of like there's nothing he can really do to make himself whole again. And I think it's really interesting to have not just like an American movie, but sort of a big prestige studio picture released a year after the Gulf War, right? That's just sort of like violence is the worst thing we can do to each other, and there's no coming back from it. It's just sort of it's a very final thing. And I think that's sort of like a kind of profound thing to have out in the world. In that way. So yeah, 95. It's just, and like we've said, it's beautiful to look at. It's like, you know, the Gene Hackman sort of monologuing in the jail is just sort of so pleasurable to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
It's also, you know, we talked about this. We have talked about all of the Best Picture nominees at this point, Emily.
Hell yeah. I think we have.
I think we have. Unforgiven, Howard's End, A Few Good Men, Scent of a Woman, and The Crying Game. It's a real
I'll say real this, murders, the right? Only one of those that I don't like is Scent of a Woman. I like all of them to some degree, though this and Howard's End are clearly a cut above the others.
Yeah, this I mean, it's interesting. Watching this again, you know, and I'd never seen Howard's End. Have you seen Howard's End, Jamel?
I've never seen Howard's End.
Yeah, it's a very, very good movie. And I was really kind of blown away by it. And I was curious as to seeing this again, which this movie is. I do prefer this film to it. This movie's just head and shoulders above really all the nominees. Mm-hmm. But to your point that you were making, Jamel, like this is a dark ass movie. This is a really like nihilistic, dark movie about how we kill people and how it kills us in the process. And, you know, all the Oscars, all the flowers. It's just kind of amazing.
Yay.
So next week, we have the King Cast guys coming on, Eric Bespy and Scott Wampler, to talk about Memoirs of an Invisible Man. John Jesus. Carpenter's... I know you're a big John Carpenter guy, Jamel, so I'm curious, not just your feelings on this movie, but also just to kind of get some thoughts on John Carpenter as a filmmaker from you.
Thoughts on John Carpenter as a filmmaker first. Sure. I am a big John Carpenter guy. I'm a big John Carpenter guy because I admire his resourcefulness as a filmmaker. He is a guy who's never been blessed with very big budgets, but is able to sort of like wring out lots of incredible stuff with the resources he has. I think he is like one of our great political filmmakers, and not just like an obvious movie like They Live, but sort of The Thing, which may be my favorite Carpenter, I think is sort of like a brilliant movie about not just paranoia or whatever, but about like political life in conditions of duress. You know, if I had stuck to my like political theory thing in college and gone to grad school, like I totally could write like a paper about The Thing sure. as a work of political theory. So I enjoy all of his movies. I enjoy the fact that he seems to find lots of different kinds of things kind of frightening and scary and spooky. So it's not just slasher killers. It's not just monsters and aliens. It's not just capitalism. But like, it's also the devil. It's like, hey, sure. Devil's really fucking scary, guys. So I don't know. I enjoy basically every John Carpenter movie except Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which I think has less to do with Carpenter and more to do with Chevy Chase.
Yeah, fair.
Being kind of like insufferable to watch on screen, and kind of like there's a version of this movie that is like much bleaker and Carpenter-esque.
Sure.
In that version of the movie, maybe it stars Sam Neill in the title role,
sure.
And not Chevy Chase, but it does not star Chevy Chase.
So I'm curious. I mean, when just on the Carpenter side, were you a young man when Carpenter got his hooks in you? Like, was there a film of his that you saw that just really kind of blew you away? And I'm just kind of curious as to like when you saw Memoirs in your journey through.
Memoirs is more recent when I saw, because the first Carpenter movie I ever saw was Big Trouble in Little China.
Sure.
And I was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
Which I loved.
Yep.
And so sort of like the Carpenter of like Halloween, A Big Trouble, of Escape from New York, which was a big sort of like Bowie household movie. Like my dad loves that movie. Those were the things I kind of grew up watching. But like stuff like Memoirs of a Miserable Man or the more kind of like Eldritch horror stuff. Like that's more sort of as an adult I've watched that, right. And this I think I watched for the first time last year or 2 years ago. It was just sort of like, what am I doing?
It's a rough watch. But I'll say this, just because you mentioned he doesn't that Carpenter didn't generally make studio movies, didn't get big budgets. I'll say that like I didn't like Memoirs of an Invisible Man, but all the invisible technology that he implemented looked pretty unbelievable. Like the guy is a technical filmmaker, is just kind of unimpeachable.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah, it's sort of like I wish he had been able to get this kind of budget for something that was like a passion project, like right, 100%. Like for something that really was that he was eager to do.
I really learned a lot watching that movie about how to play the stock market when you're invisible, which like is an important thing to know about.
It's an important thing for sure. Jamel, I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking with us about Unforgiven. I know you're a very busy man. I just saw you the other night on Alex Wagner's show. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on here. Truly.
Do you have
my pleasure.
Do you have anything you want to plug? Any places people can find you online? Unclear and Present Danger. Great podcast. I'll say.
Yeah. That. So I got my podcast Unclear and Present Danger about the political and military thrillers of the 1990s. We just did an episode on Nixon with the historian Nikki Hemmer. Me and my co-host John Gans. Great movie. Great movie about America's most virgin president. Richard M. Nixon. Spiritually virgin president. So we did that. And then we have a Patreon where we just did J. Edgar. So we're kind of on kind of like a Nixon mid-century kind of thing. Awesome. We previously watched Larry Cohen's The Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover, which is like a weird movie. Sure. Lots of stuff on that. Please listen. Would appreciate it. And then you can find me at the New York Times. I have a column every Tuesday and every Friday, and I have a Saturday newsletter. And so if you are still a subscriber to the New York Times, which I understand, people have mixed feelings about the New York Times, and I do not begrudge them those feelings. But if you are a reader, you should check out my stuff.
Brilliant pieces. I do want to say I was in DC in 2016, and we saw Rogue One together. And I don't know if you remember this, because at the time I was living as a person shaped husk. I was not my current vibrant self. We went to a bar to all talk about it, and by the time I realized who you were and how much I loved your work, it was like way too late for me to be like, I love your work. So I'm saying it now. Thank you for seeing Rogue One with me, and I love your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I you know, we're wrapping up, but I got to say, yes. Rogue One, a movie that people get really mad at me for my opinion of, which is that I don't think it's very good. People love Rogue One, and I am always like, the first 2/3 of that movie are incoherent.
I'll just say this. I think that part of the reason people like Rogue One is because they dislike so much of the new Star Wars output that they put it as one of the better ones. But to your point, Jamal, I think it's also a bit of a mess.
I mean, Last Jedi and Force Awakens are so much better than Rogue One. I love Last Jedi. At the time, I was the one person in this conversation who kind of liked Rogue One, and I have been baffled. And like Andor has retroactively made me like it slightly more, but I still am baffled by the reception to it. It did lead to the stupidest time. People got mad at me online, so that's fun. You can go look that
up. Really? People got mad at you online?
I put in the headlines, Rogue One is the first time a Star Wars movie is engaged with the reality of war or something like that. And then people were like, but Wars is in the title. And then they all got mad at me. Late 2016.
Dumb people.
Dumb people.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember thinking, well, that's obviously the case. Like, have you watched the Star Wars? Like, the Wars actually is not a big part of the movie.
Anyway.
Well, again, thank you so much, Jamal. I hope to talk to again in the future, but this was an absolute blast. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.